Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices. I'm Joanna Hernandez. Here's what we're looking at. An effort to streamline the city's shelter system to include both asylum seekers and longtime Chicago residents who are unhoused. A local nonprofit says it's at risk of losing their state funding, what it could mean for their community. Are people loving monarch butterflies to death? A new study suggests human efforts to save them is contributing to their decline.
I would say just vibrant in color and sound. I think that we're really going all out to stimulate all of the senses.
And details on a free puppet show celebrating El Día de los Muertos. And now to some of today's top stories. Chicago has seven new school board members. They were all sworn in at today's Board of Education Committee meeting. It's the first time the new board has met since the prior board resigned amid ongoing tensions between Mayor Brandon Johnson and Chicago Public Schools CEO Pedro Martinez. Martinez, who was also at today's meeting, has said in recent weeks the mayor asked him to resign his position, but he has refused to do so. Johnson is not able to fire Martinez. That decision can only come from the board itself. There's more on the new board members on our website. And the train operator in a crash on the CTA Yellow Line had alcohol in his system. That's according to a new report by the National Transportation Safety Board. The train slammed into a snowplow on the tracks last November, injuring more than a dozen people. The NTSB has not yet issued its final report. And backers of a referendum on the Illinois ballot say it'll lead to property tax relief. Even though the question is just advisory, the question asks voters to weigh in on whether the Illinois Constitution should be changed so millionaires pay a higher income tax to fund property tax relief. Former Governor Pat Quinn and Congressman Jesus Chuy Garcia are among supporters urging a yes to vote. They say even though the results are not legally binding, lawmakers will consider the results when crafting policies in the future. For more on what's in the November ballot, check out our voter guide. And advocates for after-school programs are urging the state to release $50 million in grant funds. The grant money is set to support student programming throughout the city and state. Advocates say organizations have already had to cut youth programming across Illinois, with more to come by the end of the year.
These programs provide that beacon of light in communities to keep kids safe. By Christmas, this number will be 2,000 people have lost their jobs, and 27,500 students will be without programming.
And coming up, changes to how the city will house new arrivals and longtime unhoused residents. A local leader joins us next to explain how it would all work.
Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Chicago is set to overhaul its migrant shelter system in the new year, limiting beds to asylum seekers who have been in the city for less than 30 days. The new unified approach, known as the One System Initiative, aims to streamline services for both migrants and longtime unhoused residents. But concerns linger over the potential overflow in the city's ability to support both populations amid rising demand for shelter. Joining us now with more is Beatriz Ponce de Leon, Deputy Mayor of Immigrant, Migrant, and Refugee Rights. Thank you for joining us. So let's start off. Can you just explain the One System Initiative and how it will streamline the city's approach to sheltering new arrivals and longtime unhoused residents?
Yes, and thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity. You know, when we started the new arrival shelter system, it grew very, very quickly. At a point, we had 15,000 people in that system, and we just knew that that was not sustainable. We also heard loud and clear from community that they were concerned about our shelter capacity for other unhoused Chicagoans. And so we began to partner with the state to move towards a unified system, which is the One System Initiative. What we just announced this week is that we will be closing the New Arrivals Mission, and in January, that one unified shelter system will be in operation. The way it'll work is that some of the beds from the New Arrivals system, those shelters will remain in place into the new year. All of the policies, though, that will manage this shelter system will be the ones that the traditional shelter system has. So there will no longer be term limits or shelter stay limits. And people will still be in separated families with children, adults in separate spaces. Over time, the populations of, you know, new arrivals and other Chicagoans will come together, but that transition will take some time.
It seems like a big initiative. You know, why is the city moving to this system? Mm-hmm.
Well, like I said, it is something that we've been planning for. We knew we needed a more equitable system. For years, Chicago has only had 3,000 beds in our homeless DFSS-operated system, and that was just never enough. And so we tried to work together again with the state, financial commitments from both city and state to make this combined system. It aligns with our new fiscal year, so it's kind of a clean break. But also, we have budgetary constraints. Like, the reality is that we were not able to maintain the level of capacity that we have had given our budget. Across the city, we're having to look at ways that we better manage the budget or, you know, make some cuts to help us get to a balanced budget, and this is one of those ways.
Yeah, and under the new system, only 3,800 beds will be made available for asylum seekers. How does the city plan to, you know, address potential overflow, especially during those winter months?
We've put a couple things in place to try to bring down the number of people that will need shelter. One of them is the limit to who is eligible for the first-time placement. So the very first time that people come to Chicago and ask for shelter, if they're asylum seekers, we will only be providing shelter for people who've been in the U.S. for 30 days or less. Our hope is that by getting that message out, and we've already started to communicate that at the border in other ways, is that people will make choices before they come here about knowing, understanding what the limitations are. We have had the most expansive shelter policy and shelter system of any U.S. city up until now. And I am proud of the fact that we've welcomed about 50,000 people. We've prevented all of those folks from becoming unsheltered and connected them to many, many resources in partnership with the state and others. We have to now make a shift as we go into this new year.
I can imagine not everyone's happy about the shift.
Yes, it'll be a challenge for many.
And talking about the landing zone, you mentioned that will also be closing, and which is a location where asylum seekers would arrive via bus. Now, what would that look like if there were people to arrive?
We haven't had a bus in the Chicago area since June, but people do come on their own. About a third are coming directly from the border states, and so we know that there will be some folks who will still come. As we phase out the landing zone, on November 1st, the landing zone will go to, instead of being overnight operations, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. And then by December 15th, the landing zone and the state's intake center will both be closed. We are working towards, as part of the One System, a new physical access point that anyone who needs shelter can go to. And that is a collaboration state and city to have a new place that you can go to, request shelter for whatever reason, and have an assortment of supports and resources to meet your specific needs. We can't guarantee a shelter bed for everyone. We will have 68 beds available starting in January. But people will be given the opportunity to request shelter and be, you know, if there's a space available, be placed in shelter.
And talking about homelessness, I mean, this is something that Chicago has talked about, that advocates have talked about. You know, how do you go about when advocates say, you know, there's not enough spaces or shelters for people who are already living out? Mm-hmm. How does that work in combining everything together?
Yeah. Well, I think the goal of this system was to have a bigger, better system for all. And we are going from 3,000 beds to 6,800 considered permanent beds. These are beds that will now be part of Chicago's homeless services system. What we anticipate will happen is that new arrivals will start to move out the way they have. They now have a community here. At the beginning of this, you know, people were new to the city. There was no community, Venezuelan, Colombian community, or Haitian community large enough to really help each other. But that is different. We now have, again, around 50,000 people. And we are working with the state to connect people again through rental assistance, connecting them to other nonprofit resources, helping people in their journey for work permits, hopefully getting them to a point where they don't need to be in shelter and they can be moving out. It will be a challenging time. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. And we are doing our best to support people and prevent people from becoming unsheltered. We will need to, you know, also see in the past, and people still are doing this, churches and others that have stepped up to support. And I think Chicago demonstrated throughout this whole crisis that folks have been able to come together. Chicagoans are very generous.
Yeah. And when you talk about, you know, a challenging time, what would you say is the biggest concern?
The biggest concern is not being able to provide shelter for everyone that needs it. We are, again, doing our best to connect people to resources, but I think that we will see through this, and hopefully in this coming year we'll have a better system that is able to serve more people and do it well linguistically, culturally, with wraparound supports for anyone.
Now, there is concerns that integrating migrant shelters with shelters for longtime Chicago residents might create tension or strain resources. How is the city addressing those concerns?
We already have new arrivals in some homeless services shelters, and those shelters have figured out the right balance. But part of the One System initiative and the recommendations that came to us from providers in the working groups is to have additional training to provide, you know, bringing in organizations that know how to work with different populations. And I think that as that work continues, it will build the capacity of our shelter system to do that. Our chief homelessness officer, Sandy Soto, will also be launching a plan to create a 5-year plan for addressing homelessness. And part of that work will be to look at those One System recommendations and to look at how to strengthen the system as a whole.
Well, thank you for joining us and for that update.
Thank you so much.
Up next, our efforts to save monarch butterflies doing more harm than good. We explore that right after this. People have an infatuation with monarch butterflies, and that's especially seen in the Mexican culture, as monarchs symbolize a connection between the living and the dead. Those fond connections to the beloved species have resulted in efforts to bring the butterflies back from the brink of extinction. But a new study from the University of Georgia suggests we may be doing more harm than good to our winged friends. Our own Patty Wetley joins us now to tell us more. Patty, I have to tell you, monarch butterflies are one of my favorite species. You know I love them. We've talked about it before.
Yes.
So monarch butterflies annually migrate to Mexico.
Yes.
But what did the study find about their migration?
Well, it found it took like 17 years of data, of observations of their roosts, which is how they kind of all hang out together in trees when they're resting. And the size of those roosts gets smaller and smaller and smaller the further they get toward Mexico. And so the question is, why are we losing so many of them along the route? Are they stopping their migration? Are they dying? Do they lose the ability to migrate? So those are the concerns as they're seeing the numbers drop off. They start off strong, and then so many of them don't make it to Mexico.
What did you find so interesting about the study?
Well, one of the culprits, as you mentioned, seems to be what's called tropical milkweed. That is a non-native milkweed. Everybody's been told plant milkweed, milkweed, milkweed. There's native kinds, but tropical milkweed is not native. It's bad because it has this parasite in it that does all sorts of things to the monarch in terms of being either deadly, they can't reproduce as well, they can't fly as well, but it also kind of messes with their ability to judge when they should migrate because it stays flowering so much longer in the north, they could miss their cue that they need to head south. Another issue is everybody wants to captive rear their monarchs. They want to bring in those caterpillars and make them safe and then release them. And those have been proven to not be as fit to make that trek south. So we might be thinking we're planting milkweed, that's great. we're keeping them safe and then releasing them. Great, but those things could actually be leading to declines in numbers.
That's so interesting. I had no idea.
I know. But that's what I'm here for.
Yeah, that's what you're here for. Well, I hope we can continue to keep the monarch safe.
Oh, we all do.
Thank you, Patty.
Thanks.
And you can read Patty's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. Residents on the city's northwest side may be losing access to programs provided by a local community organization. That's because the nonprofit Hermosa Neighborhood Association says it's set to lose their state funding in June. The state awarded $244 million in grants using funds generated from taxes on cannabis sales to support and invest in underserved communities. As a grant ends, date approaches, community organizers are working to figure out what comes next. Joining us now with more are Jeanette Pacheco, president of Hermosa Neighborhood Association, and Nalma Cruiser, the group's founding member and vice president. We also invited the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority that handles a grant, but they declined to join us. They did send us a statement, and we will get to that later. Thank you both for joining us. Now, I want to start off with you. Your organization was launched from a conversation about the community between you and residents. Can you tell us briefly about the Hermosa Neighborhood Association? Alma?
Oh, sure, of course. So the Neighborhood Association started back in a group of neighbors met in 2014, and it was five members, Colin Bird being our original president, and we are super grateful to him for having done all the work to be where we are today.
Yeah.
And then we got our nonprofit status in 2015, and we were virtual up until like 2.5 years ago when we got the grant.
And what was the motivation to open the organization? Oh,
just, you know, we all agreed that our community needed more services, more attention. So we just did everything virtually. We had our community meetings to bring more information to our community. Whether that be information on like ComEd, where they can bring low income information to our residents, bringing in free light bulbs, anything like that.
And Jeanette, you saw the need in your community? What was that like?
Well, the need is great, especially for the youth. We're having a safe place for myself, raising three children, where resources were very scarce. We needed to make sure that not only do we provide a safe space for youth teens from 12 to 19 to have somewhere to go, feel safe, but also have some skill building, things that are necessary with our generations nowadays that some of them may lack some of the social skills. So we've seen them come in, flourish, have a safe space.
So it seems it was really a labor of love to bring
labor
this together.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeanette, can you tell us about the organization's current financial status or the situation?
Yes. So ICJA, we are very grateful to them. We have a three-year grant that is going to expire in June of 2025. We are an all-volunteer board, so we have been able to hire some staff to run the program on a daily basis, but we are not grant writers by any means. So we have a struggle, just like other organizations in our neighborhoods, that we need people to walk us through, guide us through some of that. When we do receive the funds, what are some of the things that we need to do in order to have those timelines set where, you know, we need to, you know, get additional funds? What do we do to get that guidance and collaboration?
It could be a tedious process.
Yeah, it's a very tedious process, and it's hours and hours, and something we don't have, and we're a small organization.
And Alma, I want to go to you. What would you say the opportunities that the R3 grant create for the organization?
Oh, it's huge. It's the opportunities to bring the children, giving the children a space to go to. Having spent a lot of time at the office lately, I've seen what it has done to our children. The kids that started with the program have flourished. I mean, they came in quiet, not speaking to one another, to now they come in. They just walk in after school because they come in, do their homework, and just hang out.
So you see a difference.
Oh, completely.
And I do want to read a statement from the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority. They say, in part, hundreds of community organizations across Illinois have innovative ideas for rebuilding neighborhoods torn apart by so-called war on drugs. R3 was designed to bring grant funding, equity, fairness, and opportunity to each one of them. We strongly encourage organizations to develop a sustainable plan over their three-year grant period to ensure continued service provision where their R3 grant ends. Now, Jeanette, was enough done by your organization to create a long-term sustainable plan?
Well, when we received the funding, we were very grateful to our former board members who actually wrote the grant and did a fabulous job. I myself am not a grant writer. I am more of a compliance person. I'm a private business owner. So having all that compliance and reporting has taken up a lot of my time, and we've had to adjust and make sure that we can do that to keep the boots on the ground going every day. So, you know, I've attended whatever I can as far as training is concerned, as far as anything that they need me to do, I've done.
And what's your message to them right now?
First of all, our message is that we're very grateful for the opportunity. The funding means so much, and we've done the work, the boots on the ground, we've done the work, and you see the success stories. They've had the opportunity to visit our office and see where we've applied all the funds, to see our R3 printing, to see our Cricut makers, to see the sewing programs where kids just need some basic skills.
And you don't want that to end.
We don't want that to end, and we have children that have actually started small businesses, and that's the thing that we're
I wanted to
do.
Talk about yes. The small businesses, Alma.
Yes.
You mentioned that one of your students who completed one of your programs was able to start their own business. What has a grant provided for the community?
Mm-hmm. So what has a grant provided?
Yeah, what kind of business does he have?
Oh, mm-hmm. I think he and his mother created this cart that they take to events, and they sell their, I think, like Choodles, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. But it's a beautiful thing. And he created everything through our program, including the stamps, his little logo. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing. I wish that we could, I had some photos to share of his actual business.
Mm-hmm. So the thought of losing this money, you say, is crucial.
It's crucial. I mean, that's just an example mm-hmm. of what could happen. And then using him, the other kids can look to him saying, I could do that. What can I do? You know, rather than hang out in the street, you know, being more productive, maybe thinking ahead, thinking to the future of what they can do.
And Jeanette, what support are you looking for from the community?
We're looking for support, anyone that has time to volunteer, instructors that could come in and maybe help with different programs or the programs that we have now. We're looking for the businesses that are in Hermosa to help us, because not only is this providing a safe space for the youth, it's also providing a safe space for their workers to come into work every day and to help with Hermosa. We're sandwiched between these amazing other neighborhoods, and we need someone to just look our way.
Well, thank you for joining us, and I hope you continue to find the funding.
Thank you for having us.
Up next, a colorful performance ahead of El Día de los Muertos. We share the details right after this. A puppet show is celebrating El Día de los Muertos, the Mexican holiday where people honor their loved ones who have died. Traditionally, families gather in the cemetery during this celebration to welcome the souls of their loved ones. Others prepare altars known as ofrendas, filled with photos, flowers, candles, and sugar skulls. We got a sneak peek of the show coming to the Harold Washington Library.
Well, I would say just vibrant in color and sound. I think that we're really going all out to stimulate all of the senses.
The name of the show is Day of the Dead Live. The inspiration, the idea was to do a series of concerts that brought in Llewellyn's like Mexican-American heritage, Mexican heritage, and blend them a little bit with some European macabre diabolic music for Halloween.
It's a day where we celebrate and make an offering to people from the past, people not with us anymore, may they be in family, may they be, you know, friends of ours. And it's just an opportunity to remember them and know that their spirits are always with us.
All of the songs are little vignettes that tell different stories. So there is Jarabe Tapatío, which that's when all the revolutionaries come in, because it was like a revolutionary song. So the characters in it include like the revolutionary artists like Frida Kahlo, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, who's a writer in the... Or the muralist, Diego Rivera, Orozco, Cisqueros, we have Pancho Villa.
I'm the pianist, I'm the musician, so I am bringing all of this music to life, but with an incredible team around me.
in this moment. There's some very strong negative feelings about immigrants, and I just want to make sure that everybody remembers that immigrants and the sharing of culture enriches all of our lives.
I was very lucky to grow up in a Mexican-American family. My mom was born in Guadalajara. She's a tapatía. So I know that it's making a lot of my family happy that I'm doing this project, but it's been an opportunity for me to explore a part of my heritage that means so much to me.
The family-friendly show will kick off at the Harold Washington Library for opening night on Tuesday and will run through Friday from November 1st. Now, there will be shows in English and Spanish. We have all that information on our website, and I can tell you it's a beautiful celebration. And that's our show for this Thursday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7 and 10 for the Weekend Review. Now, from all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe. Good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its 20 attorneys recognized in the 2025 edition of the Best Lawyers in America.